Hi, I'm Ivan Semenek. Welcome to The Universe in Mind. This week, embracing the eternal. We know the Big Bang started the universe, but what started the Big Bang? And how long will it go on? Cosmologist Alan Guth helps us imagine a reality that just keeps on going and going. Also, Lights Out on Broadway. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to stand in Times Square and just turn it all off for a minute? We'll meet an artist who's on a one-woman mission to make it happen. So stay with us. It's The Universe in Mind, the show that promises to leave you in the dark and put stars in your eyes. Just about 30 years ago, Alan Guth had what he, in his own words, calls a spectacular realization. At the time, Guth was a young physicist working at Stanford University. His idea was that some of the thorniest problems in cosmology could be solved if you just made one rather bizarre assumption, that the universe we see today began with a sudden and rapid increase in size, growing by at least 100,000 billion trillion times in an instant. Since then, Guth's idea, generally known as cosmic inflation, has become the leading theory that explains the origin of our universe. And so far, it's been remarkably consistent with observations. Today, Alan Guth is a professor of physics at MIT, and he's working on an even bigger idea, something called eternal inflation, which postulates that our universe is just a small pocket that condensed out of a much larger space where inflation is the norm. One of the attractions of this idea is that it seems to point towards the kind of reality suggested by string theory, one in which there are an infinite number of pocket universes where different laws of physics may apply. There are problems with this idea, though. For example, if there is an infinite number of universes, then probability dictates that anything that can happen will happen an infinite number of times, from a coin never landing with tail side up to a human brain popping into existence out of thin air. Recently, I spoke with Alan Guth, and I asked him about these and other mind-boggling ideas that are the currency of theoretical cosmology. Here's that conversation now. Alan Guth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'd like to start with your best cocktail party version of inflation. I mean, imagine you're talking to, I'm sure this happens a lot, you're talking to a group of people who may not be intimately familiar with cosmology. How do you present to them this monumental idea?
Well, I guess I usually start by saying that inflation is a twist on the conventional Big Bang theory. It actually just changes what we're proposing for the first tiny fraction of the first second of the history of the universe. But during that tiny fraction of a second, important things happen, and basically the initial conditions that set up the stage for the rest of the evolution of the universe are all set.
And what leads you to that conclusion?
The real gap in the conventional Big Bang theory is that despite the fact that it's called the Big Bang theory, what it really says nothing about at all is the Big Bang, that is the actual mechanism that drove the universe into this gigantic period of expansion that we're still part of. The scientific version of the Big Bang theory really just starts after the Big Bang. It describes the aftermath of some kind of an explosion. So the real gap that inflation is filling in is it's supplying a mechanism for the propulsion of the Big Bang. And what it takes advantage of is a feature of Einstein's version of gravity, which is the theory of general relativity. In Newton's theory of gravity, gravity is always attractive, and that's sort of the kind of gravity that we're all familiar with. But according to general relativity, there are circumstances under which gravity could act repulsively, and that is the basic mechanism that inflation uses to provide a description of how the universe may have gotten into this period of expansion.
So what would you say is the status of inflation as an idea today?
Well, I'm biased, so it's probably hard to decide whether what I think makes a difference or not. Inflation, I think, is very well established, if not as the correct theory of how the universe started, at least as the most plausible theory we know of. But initially, there was no real data to support it. It explained a number of features of the universe that we knew about, but they were qualitative features. And in fact, initially, there was something of a contradiction between the prediction that inflation made for the mass density of the universe and what was actually observed. Nobody claimed to know the mass density of the universe terribly reliably, so it wasn't clear how important this contradiction was. But actually, as time went on, the measurements seemed to become more secure, and the measurements were pointing towards an answer that was only about a third of what inflation was predicting. That all changed dramatically in about 1998, when the acceleration of the universe was discovered. That led to a dramatic shift in our picture of what the universe today looks like, because if the universe is accelerating, there has to be stuff in it to make it accelerate. We're not sure yet what that stuff is. We call it dark energy, for lack of a better word. But even without knowing what it is, we can still calculate with pretty good accuracy, we think, how much material is needed to cause this acceleration. And when that gets added in, the total mass density is now essentially exactly what inflation predicts. And it's just a beautiful agreement, a very nice change from the way it was a decade ago.
Now, I know cosmologists, like all scientists, are supposed to be objective about how they approach reality. But is there a kind of attachment you feel to the idea that stirs your heart when these things fall into line?
Oh, sure. Well, I think even if we pretend to be objective, we're still always happy when our theories work, because that means that we're making progress in understanding things. And if it really is a theory that one has personally been involved in for a long time, one feels all the more attached to it and all the more elated when data comes in suggesting that the theory may actually be right.
Now, we've been talking about the successes of inflation. I want to push into less comfortable territory, which is, you know, if inflation is dealing with or helping us understand how the Big Bang happened, there's this question of why inflation happened and how it might relate to something larger. And I know we're at this point where, you know, you're looking into eternal inflation. So I'd like to get a sense of what is eternal inflation and what is it about the inflationary universe that leads in that direction?
Eternal inflation simply means that once inflation starts, it never completely stops. It stops in places, and if this theory is right, we would be living in one of those places where inflation has stopped. But in other places, far away from what we can see, inflation would still be going on. And in most of these models, the inflation literally goes on forever. And that's, I guess, what eternal is supposed to mean. And it means there'd be an infinite number of places in the future where inflation will stop and universes that look like ours will form. A new vocabulary is beginning to grow around this picture. We call a region like ours, where inflation has stopped and things are happening, a pocket universe. Pocket in the sense that it's not everything that exists. And then the set of all pocket universes and everything is called the multiverse. So we have a set of essentially parallel universes, an infinite number of them perhaps, where any one of them is big enough to include everything that we see.
So it's just a dramatically larger picture than we had before, whereas we started with one universe that was expanding, which I think is already a challenge for people to get their minds around, and maybe that expansion is even speeding up. But now you're giving us a vision where this universe is just a pocket in this much larger landscape, parts of which are inflating still at that incredibly high rate, and there are other pockets as well. I want to take this apart a little bit. I guess the first question is, what motivates all of this? Because if this eternal inflation is going on and parts of this larger expanded multiverse are still inflating, it's hard to imagine what could be driving all of it. It seems like pulling energy out of nowhere.
Even if we just had one pocket universe that was inflating, energy would seem to be coming out of nowhere because it starts incredibly tiny. The total mass of the region that starts off inflation is perhaps only something on the order of a gram. So there is some magic associated with how to make a universe with essentially no energy. But it turns out to be completely consistent with the laws of physics as we know it, as we know them. The catch is that it turns out that the energy associated with a gravitational field is actually negative. And this has really been true since Newton's theory of gravity. It's also true in general relativity. And inflationary cosmology takes advantage of that fact in a big way. So what happens during inflation, even just within one pocket universe, is that as the inflation occurs, it occurs essentially at a constant density of mass or energy, but the volume is getting bigger dramatically. So that means the total energy inside this volume is getting larger and larger. But that's the total energy of the matter inside the region. There's also the energy of the gravitational field inside that region, which is negative and getting larger and larger. And the two cancel each other. So the total energy remains what it was when it started rigorously. And very likely it's zero. That is, very likely there's just a perfect cancellation between the negative energy of gravity and the positive energy of matter. So when we look out into the visible universe, in spite of the fact that we see vast amounts of matter, which by E equals mc squared implies vast amounts of energy, all of that energy is probably canceled by the negative energy of the gravitational field, which is harder to see.
So this gives me a new vision of the meaning of life. As we're sitting here in this universe, we're also helping cancel out this energy that's kind of got the whole thing expanding wildly.
Yeah, that's right. Everything that creates a gravitational field is helping to cancel out the energy.
I want to get back to this issue of why we need to have the eternal inflation and this larger framework, this larger landscape. So I guess the question is, why should we believe you? I guess we have some good answers for why we should believe in inflation, but why should we believe in internal inflation?
Right. Now, very good question. The reason basically is pretty simple. It's that the inflation that I've been discussing is driven by a material that creates this negative pressure and hence repulsive gravity. And this material is fundamentally unstable. So if you watch any little bit of it and follow what happens, you'd expect it to decay in a certain amount of time. And by decay, I mean decay like a radioactive decay. It means it disintegrates and becomes a different kind of matter, ordinary matter, with positive pressure. And when that happens, inflation ends. But like most radioactive decays, this process is probabilistic. If you watch a given uranium atom that's supposed to decay, you really have no idea when it will decay. You only know on average how often such atoms would decay. One describes radioactive decays in terms of a half-life, which means that after that amount of time, the probability is one-half that any given atom would have decayed. Similarly, one could talk about the half-life of this peculiar material with the negative pressure. And indeed, if you wait one such half-life, half of it will have decayed, by definition. The catch, though, is that this peculiar stuff, while it's decaying, is also rapidly expanding. And the expansion outruns the decay. So it has the very peculiar feature that if you wait for one half-life, half of it will have disappeared. But the half that remains will, in fact, be vastly larger than what you started with. So it doesn't disappear, even though it's decaying, but rather it keeps growing, literally exponentially, meaning it has a certain amount of time when it doubles in volume, and if you wait that time again, it will double again, and so on, ad infinitum.
We're in a universe that appears to have gone through a Big Bang, and inflation could be the mechanism that causes the Big Bang, or that explains the Big Bang. If inflation is right, we're a little patch that froze out of this larger landscape, much of which is still inflating. But what got the whole ball rolling? Or do you need something to get the whole ball rolling?
The answer, I think, is that you do need something, but we don't really know. That is, inflation, even though it discusses the first 10 to the minus 37 seconds, decimal point, 36 zeros and a one, that many seconds, it's an incredibly short time. But nonetheless, inflation is not really ultimately a theory of the origin of the universe. It's a theory of the evolution of the universe from extraordinarily early times to times which are much later, but still extraordinarily early. And inflation could explain how most of the structure that we see in the universe arose, how essentially all of the matter arose. But inflation doesn't start from literally nothing. Inflation starts from a very small, very dense universe. And how it all started is something which we don't have any good theories about. We do have speculations of theories about the ultimate beginning. But those theories are highly speculative and not very detailed. And I think the bottom line now is that we still don't really understand the actual origin of the universe.
Is this a domain where physicists are guided perhaps by philosophy as well? I mean, Aristotle imagined an eternal universe, which I guess is how he addressed the problem of where things come from. The Big Bang, I think, forced people philosophically to this idea that there must be a beginning. Could we be moving back to that earlier view that maybe there is no beginning, or that there's some kind of existence that is independent of time?
It's hard to say. Inflation itself does not really take us there, even with eternal inflation. Even with eternal inflation, as we understand it, it's eternal only into the future. And as far as we can tell, it cannot be eternal into the past. Now, that leaves open the question of what, when we finally do understand the ultimate origin of the universe, whether that will really involve something which is sort of time invariant in the long run. I don't know. Certainly, the idea that something may have already always existed is a possibility. But we just don't know at this point.
You know, we were talking earlier about the successes of inflation, and I think how satisfying that must be. But I also get the sense that you are not completely satisfied. You've got some frustrations that you're dealing with right now, in particular this question of probability. And I'm wondering if you can expand on that, and what are your current concerns?
Sure. Yeah, one concern that those of us working on inflation have now is that we've been led to this picture of eternal inflation, which seems to be almost mandatory in the context of inflationary theories. But it also raises questions. If the universe really does go on eternally, producing an infinite number of these pocket universes, it literally means that everything that can happen will happen an infinite number of times. And if everything happens an infinite number of times, it's difficult to know what you mean when you say some things are common and some things are uncommon. And in our quantum view of reality, almost everything is possible. So almost everything you can imagine, including flipping a coin and having it stick to the ceiling instead of coming down, will happen an infinite number of times in the multiverse. So to make any sense out of this in the long run, we really do need to have a way of defining probabilities in this eternally inflating universe. And that means comparing infinities, deciding that some things that happen an infinite number of times are more likely than other things that happen also an infinite number of times, because everything happens an infinite number of times. And that turns out to be hard. If things were reasonably uniform, you would think you could just take some big volume and use that as your sample and talk about what's common in that sample and what's uncommon in that sample, and then imagine taking the sample bigger and bigger and expecting it to approach some kind of a fixed limit that would be the real answer to the question. The right way of looking at it may have that form in the end, but when we try things like that, what we find is that in our inflating multiverse, the answers we get can depend very dramatically, actually, on the way in which we choose that sample volume and the way in which we get allow it to become larger and larger. So right now it's a complete puzzle, really. What's the right way to talk about defining probabilities in this multiverse? There are a number of proposals on the table. There are a number of criteria that people have invented to evaluate those proposals. Many of the proposals have died because of that. But we still don't really know any criterion to pick out what is literally the right answer. And all we've been able to do so far is to kind of narrow down the range of answers that seem plausible.
Is this a brick wall in the sense that maybe the mathematics isn't there to deal with it? Or is this the universe telling us something? What's your instinct about which way to go here?
Well, I have to admit, I'm very puzzled. I don't have a very clear instinct. I would like to think that ultimately there will be some principle that will define these probabilities. I don't think it's just a matter of missing mathematics, because we've spoken to mathematicians. They tell us it's just undefined in this situation. So I think what we need is more physics, not just more mathematics. Some physical idea which allows us to somehow figure out what's the right way to sample or to think about sampling this infinite space-time.
Does it ever drive you crazy that in an infinite number of other universes, an infinite number of Alan Guths are suddenly saying, that's the answer?
Well, I have to admit, I try to resist thinking that way. We're living in our own pocket universe and have to deal with the problems we have here. And knowing that they've probably been solved elsewhere is an interesting thought, but doesn't help a lot here.
Alan Guth, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Ivan. It's been fun.
I met with Alan Guth here in Toronto. He's a professor of physics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and author of The Inflationary Universe, The Quest for a New Theory of Cosmic Origins, published by Perseus Books. If you live in a major city, then you probably don't get much of an opportunity to see the stars. That's because when there's a lot of light around, the sky loses its contrast and turns into a flat, gray ceiling. Astronomers call it light pollution, and it's one of the hallmarks of modern urban life. Katya Aglet wants to remind us that it doesn't have to be that way, and she's thinking big. Aglet is a Swedish artist who's working on a plan to turn off all the lights in Times Square for exactly 1 minute. To find out more, I called Katya Aglet in New York. Katya Aglet, thank you very much for being on The Universe in Mind.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I would guess, as an artist, you must really have the universe on your mind to take on such a project, turning off all the lights in Times Square. How did this all come about? What is your interest in the night sky?
It started in 2006 when I was in Bangkok. I was invited there to work with a project in the public sphere in the city center of Bangkok. And during my research there, someone told me about light pollution, also about visual pollution, but it was light pollution that I found the most interesting. Because as a video artist, I'm, working with light. That is my main source of material, so to speak. So I found it very fascinating that light could be pollutive. And, of course, in Bangkok, there is loads of light pollution. And, so I had an idea to make a project based on this theme.
So then now, why Times Square? Why bring the idea to New York?
Times Square, to me, is the apt location for an art intervention related to light pollution, because Times Square is one of the, if not the, brightest sites on Earth. Actually, I read in an article last year in New York Times that Times Square is the brightest site on Earth in relation to how many people that are affected by the artificial light, so to speak. I mean, Las Vegas, for instance, is brighter, but it's not as many people that are exposed to the light during a day. So in that sense, Times Square is brighter. So it's not a critical project against Times Square in any way. I mean, it's more using, maybe I could even call it, to use it as my tool to get my message through, so to speak.
Right. And I'm curious about your message. How would you frame the artistic statement of this project?
Well, I think it has, of course, lots of layers. But my starting point is light pollution. That's the reason for me to want to do this intervention. And my vision is that when the commercial lights are turned out for 1 minute, as a silent minute, but a dark minute in Times Square, the architecture and the landscape will provide, will look different, which will provide a perspective on the site, which will remind people about another kind of landscape, an alternative landscape, a landscape that is slower. The signs are very powerful in terms of speed as well, not only light. So the speed will slow down, the light will turn out, the whole scenario will remind us much more of another kind of landscape that is closer related to nature. And I see, the universe and the stars as, part of nature.
I can really imagine it as you're speaking. I get this impression of a canyon of buildings, these dark buildings that would be like cliffs rising up. Now, is it just Times Square itself, or, how many lights, how much of an area are you talking about getting to switch off?
the size of the area that I want to work with is Broadway and 7th Avenue between approximately 40th to 50th Street, so it's about 10 blocks. And it's about 20 buildings. The number of signs varies very much on the facades. Like some of the buildings only have one sign, other buildings have, you know, many more.
And does it include street lights as well and all the
No functional light, only the commercial lights.
So how do you get this to happen? I mean, you mentioned 20 buildings. That's quite a few people that you have to convince. How are you doing that?
I have been communicating, and I am in communication with building owners as well as organizations. You have to get everyone on board or it won't happen. I mean, it's all or nothing, so to speak.
Right. Otherwise, it's a great advertising opportunity for the one person who doesn't turn out the lights.
Yeah, depends on how you see it, perhaps.
Right. So they all have to do it. And what has the response been like?
The response has been people are very, very positive to the project. So I'm very happy for that. You know, it's a great opportunity for sending their messages. I mean, the signs will be turned back on, you know, 60 seconds later.
Right.
So the advertisement on those signs will be even more visible, you know, when they are turned back.
Is there a preferred time of night or time of the week where you think this would be an ideal moment?
I think around new moon and between dusk and midnight.
And presumably people will be on their way to the theater and you'll be giving them a different kind of performance.
Yeah, perhaps. Absolutely. I mean, depends on when it happens. It could also be like when they are on their way from the theaters. You know, it will be a kind of performance they never had before, I guess.
Now, we live in a time where most of the world's population now live in cities, and there are some very large cities around the world. I'm curious what you think we're missing by not seeing the sky in its natural state?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's a question that I've been asking lots of the people that I've been interviewing myself during my research, because it feels as if it's obvious that it has to make a difference. You know, it can't be healthy to not being able to see the universe, in my mind anyway, because I think if we look up in the sky and there's a cover at the top of our heads, that will make us think we are limited rather than unlimited, since the idea or the sense that you get when looking up in the universe is that, wow, you know, this is limitless. And it's a sort of a liberating, and you start to actually think big ideas when looking out in space.
Well, Katja Aglet, I think that's a phenomenally good reason for doing this, and obviously you're not someone who's short on big ideas. So good luck with this project. We hope you get a chance to see the lights out on Times Square.
Thank you very much. I will do my best.
Well, we'll be anxiously waiting to hear what happens, and thanks for speaking with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Katja Aglet is a visiting artist at Swing Space and a grantee of the Lower Manhattan Cultural Council. She's hoping to realize her project, called One Starry Minute, later this spring. And that's it for this episode of The Universe in Mind. Remember, you can subscribe to our show on iTunes. The Universe in Mind is brought to you by the Dunlap Institute for Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Toronto. Kathy Parrott is our online producer. Thanks also to Hugh Zhao and Angela Choi. Our cover art is by Bettina Forget, with graphics by Efahan Elby. I'm Ivan Semenek. Be sure to check in with me next week for more news and conversations about the world of astronomy. And in the meantime, don't forget to keep the universe in mind. Thanks.